Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
It's late spring in Santa Monica, and that means it's cherry season at the farmer's market. Whether you like a dark red Brooks or the bright pop of an early Glen, they're all here.
I've been coming to the Santa Monica Farmers Market for at least a couple of decades, and I harass all the farmers every year, where are my cherries all year long. Even in December, after cherry season's over, I'm ready for some more.
I met Mitchell Krause while waiting in line for the first great week of the season. He's what you might call a cherry aficionado, and he says there's one particular cherry that towers above them all.
I love trying, and I'll get mixed cases and a little bit of every different cherry I can. And the day I found the Black Republicans, I said, okay, this is what a cherry is perfected.
Tell me a little bit about why you love the Black Republican cherries.
I just love how deep their flavor is. They have a great crunch. You know, my hands are sort of blood purple afterwards because the flavor is just so intense and the juice is so intense. But the flavor and the texture together, it's just somebody who eats a couple pounds of cherries a day this time of year, those are by far my favorite.
Of all the unusual names for cherries, few have raised as many questions as the Black Republican. But the story behind that cherry is as rich and complex as the flavor itself. It begins with one family in Iowa and swells to include the Underground Railroad, the Oregon Trail, and the birth of the Pacific fruit industry. For KCRW, I'm Tyler Boudreau, and this is The Blacker the Cherry. I discovered Black Republican cherries in a moment of serendipity that began with a case of the munchies. My father-in-law, Peter Kagan, runs a gourmet shop in Topanga Canyon, and one night when we were at his house, my fiancé Michael, his brother Benji, and I decided to raid the kitchen fridge. The first thing we saw were these several gallon-sized bags of fresh cherries. We poured each variety into bowls and indulged in them like we were tasting wine. Each one had a fascinating ratio of tart to sweet, and the Rainiers tasted like candy. The Bings had that classic sweet composition. But the standout of the bunch was the deeply rich and intensely complex flavor of the Black Republican. Of course, as a Black woman, that name instantly piqued my interest. I knew that there had to be more to the name than its dark flesh. So I jumped down the rabbit hole to chase the cherries. The story of the Black Republican cherry begins with Henderson Llewellyn. He was the eldest son of a Quaker family who ran a successful nursery in Iowa in the late 1830s. Their stock included 35 varieties of small fruits like apples, pears, peaches, plums, and cherries. Nowadays, his house in Salem has been preserved as the Llewellyn Quaker Museum. It's also a federally recognized landmark, but not because of their fruit trees. The Llewellyn house became famous as a stop on the Underground Railroad.
The Quakers, the Society of Friends, other faith groups such as the Congregationalists, were strong-minded in terms of their belief that God expected them to do something about this terrible treatment of human beings. And we're only 20 miles from Missouri, so the Missouri Compromise in 1820 had said that Maine is a free state and Missouri is a slave state. So all along the Missouri-Iowa border, you had this increasing tension, beginning with the settlement in the 1830s all the way through the Civil War of the African-Americans, slaves. We refer to them sometimes as freedom seekers as they find their way northward, making their way north towards Canada day by day, mile by mile, and coming through this little town of Salem, which was a Quaker settlement. Salem developed early on a reputation as a place where the runaway slaves were held. And that did not set too well with the slave owners in Missouri. So Henderson Llewellyn was involved in that. The whole Llewellyn family were activists. They had some unique qualities. The family was quite remarkable in their adventurism, their creativity, their business acumen, their fascination with grafting trees, and their intense abolitionist bent. They were fire breathers here when it comes to the issue of abolition, when not everyone was.
Hellman says that the Llewellyns were descended from Welsh immigrants who gradually made their way west.
In the mid-1600s, 1700s, about 5,000 Welsh families came to America, most into southeastern Pennsylvania because William Penn, a Quaker, owned that land. The Llewellyns, the name is spelled about a dozen different ways back through history, but our spelling originated there in Pennsylvania, and they were nurserymen. They brought with them from England the process of growing and grafting fruit trees. They heard about rich soil in North Carolina, so they moved to North Carolina. They settled, they grew their trees. But what was happening in North Carolina did not set well with the Quakers because it was, of course, a very active slave economy, very harsh economy with large numbers of Africans being captured on the west coast of Africa, brought to America. And many of them were being brought to the Central Carolinas because of two crops, which were tobacco and cotton. They heard about more rich soil in the west. The west at the time was Indiana. And they moved to Indiana into the Cumberland Gap. Young Henderson was only about 15 when he came. He married at age 21 a young 15-year-old girl, Elizabeth. Remarkable woman, truly remarkable woman. And they farmed. They had four children. They established their orchards. And then they heard about more rich soil, and that was Iowa. Henderson and one brother came here, settled at the town of Salem, and prospered with the grafting of the trees.
Llewellyn and his brother were hardly the only abolitionists in Iowa. But Llewellyn took his convictions one step further. He built them into the literal fabric of his house.
Every farm had to have its own orchard. There were no grocery stores. Early pioneers knew that fruit was critical to the well-being of the health and families. If you look at the early maps of the farms in Iowa, every one of them had an orchard. So this was their business. But Henderson Llewellyn built his home, fairly substantial for the time. Most homes were log with dirt floors. He built one made of stone cut from a quarry. And he built in that home at least two hiding places that were used in the process of assisting those freedom seekers escaping bondage in Missouri as they made their way north. All of the Quakers disagreed with slavery, but not everyone wanted to take the risk. If you harbored slaves in your home, in your barn, in your orchard, in your haymow, and an agent or a bounty hunter caught you doing it, or a law enforcement officer, you could receive a pretty stiff penalty, up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. Our tour guides talk about when one or two or three of the slaves were found in the woods and brought to Salem. It could be a husband and a wife, or a mother and a child, or a man and a child. Older people never made this trip. It was just too harsh. They stayed on the plantation. But the women in Salem would go to work. They would prepare clothing. They would prepare food. They would try to package food so that it could be put in backpacks and make the way north. They knew sometimes there were sick children and they would have to care for the children. And so it was a little cottage industry of caring for people who were coming to them in pretty bad shape. They had a strong will, but they would have been tired, exhausted, and afraid. And the views were common of the Quaker faith. They were pacifists. They weren't going to take up arms, but they were able to help. And the Underground Railroad afforded an opportunity for them to do something important. It's a story of courage. The African Americans who left Missouri were courageous. That was the only thing they knew. At least it was a place. But they were courageous to leave, and the Quakers were courageous to help them.
In the late 1840s, the Llewellyns left Salem and followed the Oregon Trail out west.
In the winter of 1847, he and his neighbors, about 20 people and family, built a large wagon like a giant planter box pulled by six oxen. It had a soil in it with charcoal and soil for drainage. He put hickory strips around the edge so the livestock and the oxen wouldn't eat his trees. And they put 700 seedlings, short seedlings, they're about 6 inches to 18 inches tall, in this wagon and made their way westward. Henderson and Elizabeth by then had 8 children. Elizabeth was pregnant with number 9, and they headed west. And the story told by some of the children is quite remarkable, particularly how they were basically booted out of one wagon train because the big wagon was slowing them down and the other people didn't like it. They went on their own. 4 in their party died. None of the Llewellyns, the 8 children, Henderson, Llewellyn, and Elizabeth, made it safely. He knew something of early medicine and healthcare. His father had been something of a country doctor. We think he knew to be careful where he drank his water. Most deaths on the westward migration were from cholera and diseases such as that. And we also know that the Native Americans didn't bother him. There are accounts written by one daughter in a journal that says the Native American chiefs came into camp and had a meal with Elizabeth preparing the meal. They were fascinated by this wagon load of trees going across the prairie. They'd never seen such a thing. And to them, a tree in a forest is a sacred object and a sacred place. So this man was doing the right thing. He was caring for trees. He must be a good man. To many of them in a Native American culture, the Great Spirit lives in a forest. So this guy must be a friend of the Great Spirit. So they made it safely. Elizabeth Llewellyn walked all the way to Oregon, expecting a child. And she would later say that when you're pregnant, it's easier to walk to Oregon than ride a horse. She would give birth to the 9th child. His name was Oregon Columbia Llewellyn. He went by OC his whole life. And on the banks of the Columbia River. And she would die in childbirth the next year. My wife says the Underground Railroad and Western migration would not have worked if it weren't for the women. The men were adventurers, but the women did the work.
The Llewellyn wagon train traveled close to 2,000 miles with 700 fruit trees. They eventually settled in Milwaukee, Oregon, just south of Portland. About half of the trees survived and lived to produce many of the fruit varieties we enjoy today on the West Coast. Henderson Llewellyn is often called the father of the Pacific fruit industry. In 1852, he could sell a box of apples for as much as $75. 4 bushels shipped to the California gold mines brought $500. In 1853, Henderson left the nursery in the care of his younger brother. Things got really interesting for Henderson in the Golden State. In 1859, he experienced a spiritual awakening and sold the Fruitvale property and shipped off to Honduras to establish a utopian community. Henderson called the group the Harmonial Brotherhood. They were talking about free love 100 years before the rest of California. But by the time they arrived in Central America, most of them were starving. As they ventured further into the tropics of Honduras, many fell prey to tropical diseases like malaria and yellow fever. Eventually, they abandoned him, and he realized the fantasy of the Harmonial Brotherhood would never become reality. So he sailed back to Northern California and his fruit trees. Henderson Llewellyn died in 1878, doing what he loved best. He suffered a heart attack while planting a new orchard. Meanwhile, Seth built his brother's nurseries into a cherry empire.
Seth Llewellyn was a younger brother of Henderson. He was considered a master grafter. He just was a shrewd and wise man and clever man in grafting. But like many Midwestern adventurous men at the time, the lure of gold in California overrode everything. And he left from Indiana with his brother John to California. The record shows that it says he had some modest success finding gold. Well, it must have been pretty modest because he actually went north to Oregon and gave up gold panning in favor of helping his brother Henderson develop the orchards in the Willamette Valley south of Portland. And it was there that he and Henderson and another family and people who had come from Iowa propagated their crops. By 1852, they are producing fruit. And of course, at that time, they had the only fresh fruit in the West Coast. Everything had to go around South America or through the Isthmus of Panama westward, and that took months. So they did quite well financially. And of course, they were fascinated by the Oregon soil and the climate. This is great. We're growing.
In Milwaukee, Seth propagated three famous cherry cultivars, the Royal Anne, our heroine, the Black Republican, and the combination child of the two cherries, the Bing. Today, the Bing is the most produced variety of sweet cherry in the United States.
He named the cherry after his Chinese worker, a man who had worked with him in his orchards for several years, and his name was Bing. And he was lost for a name for the cherry. He said, Bing, I'm going to name him after you. So that's how you got your Bing cherry. Bing had come from China some years earlier and was very active with the orchards. He would later return to China to his family with goals of coming back here. But by then, the nation had the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the Chinese Exclusion Act was a harsh law that simply said, no more Chinese coming to America. So all Bing never returned to California.
Like his older brothers, Seth was a staunch abolitionist and an admirer of Abraham Lincoln. He stood against the enslavement of African peoples and the pro-slavery majority in the Democratic Party.
The Black Republican cherry is fascinating. We've attempted to research more specifically how it got that name, and we're pretty much just left with a theory. We know that Seth was intensely abolitionist. He strongly opposed slavery at every turn. The Republican Party, of course, was the party of Abraham Lincoln and became the abolitionist or anti-slavery party, as most folks know. And it was actually the Southern Democrats who were the pro-slavery political bent. And they resented the Republicans. They resented them that they would care for these Black people when they're merely property. And they actually used the term in an aggressive kind of intimidating way, a degrading term. Well, you're just another Black Republican. Calling the Republicans Black just like the Negroes were Black. Well, that was to them a very degrading term. We think that Seth may have taken that as a badge of honor. He may have said, okay, I'm a Black Republican. I'm going to name a cherry after the Black Republicans. That's only theory. We can't find anything that where he wrote that down. We don't know for sure. But it certainly seems like something he would do as a subtle act of rebellion against the Southerners, who were, of course, by that time and after that time, very active in opposing abolition.
He wanted to make his fellow farmers, their neighbors, just drool over this new cherry that was so good. And they had to name it and call it Black Republican. And the story I had heard was that they even tried to change the name to Llewellyn so that it was named after the originator of the variety, but it didn't stick. And I think they even tried another alternative, which was Black Oregon. But the name that did stick was Black Republican.
Andy Mariani is the farmer behind Andy's Orchard in the Santa Clara Valley. They're the sole distributors of Black Republican cherries in Southern California.
A lot of farmers, agricultural people, orchardists, a lot more conservative. And it's just because they're kind of old-fashioned when they grow something, you know, they want to keep everything the same. As a credit to the Whaleys, they had a great perspective from calling their first great cherry Black Republican to the second great cherry being after their Chinese workmen. And, you know, they had the Chinese Exclusion Act, but there before that, people were, a lot of Chinese were working, and they made him their foreman. This guy was really a great worker. And I think the Llewellyns themselves had a really broad perspective as far as how to get this industry started and all that. But the Llewellyns were at the forefront of liberalizing things.
Seth Llewellyn's name is painted in the Senate chamber of the Oregon State Capitol. His legacy lives on in the Milwaukee neighborhood of Llewellyn and at Seth Llewellyn Elementary School. There's yet another California connection in the Llewellyn story. Their brother John suffered from severe asthma, so in the late 1860s, he and his two sons moved up to Napa Valley for the better air. Their first crop of grapes and almonds didn't work out, but they had much better luck with olives, apples, citrus fruits, and of course, cherries. In the 1970s, John's descendants replanted his grapevines and founded Llewellyn Vineyards, a winery specializing in Cabernet Sauvignon grapes. We're now back at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Farmhands are unloading crate after crate of fresh-picked cherries. I asked the fruit detective, David Karp, of Andy's Orchards, to tell us why the Black Republican remains in such high demand. He says it all comes down to a concept known as high flavor.
What do you need for high flavor? High sugar, high acidity, and richness or complexity of flavor. And the Black Republican has that in spades. People like demand them when they're almost at the raisin state, because at that point, Black Republicans acquire an even more intense flavor, a raisinly dark, chocolatey flavor. They're also used for ice cream because they're so dark, they make a fantastic ice cream. And I know some of our buyers at the Santa Monica Market do that. I started writing about it maybe 20 years ago or so, and started just pounding the table and saying, pay attention. This is a whiny, dark, chocolatey, intense flavored cherry.
The Slow Food Foundation for Biodiversity recognizes the Black Republican in its arc of taste, a global seed bank of endangered foods that share an extraordinary heritage. Andy Mariani has watched the Black Republican's reputation change in real time.
We have all new varieties now, a lot of new varieties that are self-fertile, which is an important thing for commercial production. And you can trace the lineage of all these new varieties back through Bing and then on to Black Republican. None of them have captured that classic flavor that the Black Republican has. The biggest problem with it is its small size. And that's probably the reason why it's not a major, more widely grown as, say, the Bing. The Bing is basically an offspring of the Black Republican that's bigger. It has quite a bit of the same flavor as the Black Republican, but not quite as intense. But the problem that condemned the Black Republican for widespread commercial success is the fact that it's relatively small in size. Sometimes we couldn't sell it because we didn't have the market we have now. Well, now it's a variety that has been put on the list of the Arc of Taste, the Slow Food Organization. It has a unique flavor, and now we sell everyone that we can grow.
The Slow Food Foundation says, to lose the Black Republican cherry would be a tragedy both from a historical perspective and a gastronomical one. It is a connoisseur's cherry that has a rich, concentrated flavor despite its small size. Mariani believes that the modern retail system is fundamentally out of step with the demand for a fruit like the Black Republican.
Commercial growers are going in a completely opposite direction, to the point where when you go to a grocery store and say you're looking at plums, they don't have names for the plums. They just have yellow plum, red plum, black plum. And they don't care about the stories behind how they were developed. They don't really much care about even the flavor. They care about shelf life and appearance and maybe size. So they're using different criteria to judge commercial cultivars as opposed to some of these old heirlooms and some of the things that just are so interesting. Yet there's a commercial motive there that lacks that kind of perspective.
But the work of horticulturists like Karp and Mariani carries on the Llewellyn's legacy by growing, studying, and preserving specialty fruit.
We like the fruit and we like the story behind it. And I think David and I have dedicated our efforts toward emphasizing that. We even developed some of our own variety, and we've got little names behind it and little stories behind it because they have personalities. And certainly the Black Republican has a personality, and it also has the quality to back it up.
Although this story traveled near and far with many different flavors, characters, and connections, the singular thread found woven in this fascination with the Llewellyns, their abolitionism, horticulture, and cherries is that an open mind bears sweet fruit. I'm Tyler Boudreau. This story was hosted and produced by me, executive produced by Annyeong Zuberi Fields, and edited by Mike Dodge Weisskopf. Special thanks to Michael Kagan, and thank you to all of my guests. For links, pictures, videos, and a cherry season playlist curated by me, visit kcrw.com/blackerthecherry.